like to convene the Finance Committee, and we do have a quorum present. Representative Benson, we have minutes for April 19th.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the minutes for April 19th, 2010.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion opposed? Motion carried. The first bill we have is House File 2894 by Representative Marquardt. Representative Wagenius, if you'd move the division report.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division report for House File 2894, the first committee engrossment.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Wagenius?
I move House File 2894, the first committee engrossment be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Taxes.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Marquardt, you want to give us an update on the bill?
You bet. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I do have Mr. Ron Harnack, who's the project manager for the Red River Watershed Management Board, to answer any questions if need be. What this bill does is for watershed districts, it allows those watershed districts that have over $500 million of market value to move from the current $600,000 that they can have in loans at any one time up to $2 million. And primarily the reason is what these watershed districts will do is they need to buy up land for impoundments or water storage projects, so that it can alleviate downstream impacts. And with the price of ag land and so forth to do these projects, they need this upfront cost, and it helps them to move these projects forward more aggressively. So, Mr. Chair and members, that's my bill, and appreciate the work with Representative Wagenius and others on this.
Yeah, and some of us, when we were up in that area with the Capital Investment Committee, looked at some of those projects this past summer as well. So, okay, any discussion? Representative Chemanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Marquardt. Can you just tell me how long the $600,000 limitation was in effect?
Maybe Mr. Harnack.
Mr. Chairman, Ron Harnack, Project Coordinator with the Red River Watershed Management Board. The $600,000 went into effect in 2008.
Representative Chemanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Was there a lower limit prior to 2008?
Mr. Harnack.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, yes, it was $200,000 previous to that.
Representative Chemanski.
Mr. Chairman. And do we know how many years that was, the $200,000 limit was in effect?
Mr. Harnack?
Mr. Chairman,
there.
I do. Let me find my notes here a minute. The $200,000 went into place in 1980.
Any further discussion? Well, seeing none, then Representative Wagenius renews her motion that House File 2894, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you so much.
We'll now go to Senate File 2758, Representative Bunn. And okay, Representative Hunt.
I'll move the State Government Finance Division report for Senate File 2758, the first unofficial committee in process.
Okay, the motion is before us on the division report. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Kahn?
I move that Senate File 2758, the first unofficial committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Okay, the motion is before us, and there is an amendment, and Representative Bunn, would you like the amendment put on before you explain the bill?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Kahn?
So I'll move the amendment, the DE2 amendment, to delete everything amendment.
Okay, the amendment is before us. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Then if you'd explain the bill as amended.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We had a discussion last time I came through this committee, and the bill was directed back to Representative Kahn's State Government Finance Committee meeting because there were several unresolved issues that they wanted further discussion on. I'm just going to briefly go through how the issues were addressed that were raised in the committee that day, and also how one additional issue that was raised during State Government Finance has been addressed. Starting at the top, Representative Junkie raised the question of the issue of the bill not referring to the language to a particular section of statute. While that is common practice in general for this type of legislation, there is a component of legislation which is ongoing, so we decided that was a good idea. And so in line 1.3, we now put this language into statute related to deed for this first section of it. Secondly, Representative Buskins raised the issue of the way it was worded previously, although unintended, it was worded like a mandate, that whether or not they were able to get this private sector funding, they would still have to establish the new project and the virtual network. And so we have rephrased this such that the mandate or the directive is that they shall seek the funding to establish a network, but the directive is about seeking the funding, and if no funding is found, they would not be mandated to do the network without the funding, obviously. So we addressed that concern. Thirdly, and the big issue of discussion that day that we took up further in State Government Finance is starting at 1.18 through 1.25, we have inserted language in the bill to make sure that the OET, the Office of Enterprise Technology, has adequate oversight of any new website-related developments, whether in conjunction with the state, whether solely within the state or a private-public partnership, as in this one. So that is the language that we worked on to ensure that that oversight takes place and it meets the standards that OEC has and addresses the types of issues that are highlighted below that in bullets 1 through 3. The reason we are having the delete all today is that all the issues I just described were taken up in State Government Finance. After that was passed in State Government Finance, we learned that there was an issue regarding the phrasing of the language that we needed to address given the public-private nature of the project that we have changed in this delete-all in that portion related to the Kahn language. In addition to that, Representative Holberg raised an issue in State Government Finance that we could not address on the fly that day without further discussion with staff, was wanting to make sure there was no conflict of interest between those who might donate for the purposes of this partnership and any benefit they might receive from that. So that last piece has been addressed in this delete all on lines 1.8 through 1.10 with the line private sector funding must be for general support of the virtual network and must not be used to sponsor specific portions of the network. That language was based on some similar language Representative Holberg had asked to use in another piece of legislation and that I worked on with Mark Shepard of staff to put into the bill. So I believe we have addressed the issues that have been raised both in this last committee and also in State Government Finance with this today.
Okay, any discussion?
Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
Just thanks, Representative Kahn, for cooperation. But the language that she pointed out, 1.18 to 1.25, particularly as we do much more kind of using private networks and so forth, I would urge all members of this committee who are on other committees that I'm not on to be alert for any time someone's developing a private network that they want to then connect to the state, that this essentially the language from 1.18 to 1.25 goes into it, so that we deal with some control. And the other thing I recommend to members is to read the OET report on security. If you want to have read something to keep you up at night. But anyway, every time you see anything where that's happening, I'd like to be able to insert that language.
Okay. Any further discussion? Representative Pepper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Bunn, you might have mentioned this, and maybe I was just focusing on the bill while you were saying it, but on line 1.19, where it says the OET is subject this website is subject to the authority of the OET.
Mm-hmm.
What does subject to the authority mean exactly? Does that mean they can edit? Does that mean they can change content?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could just clarify that for me again.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, that's an excellent question. I'm not sure I have a full answer to it. Maybe Representative Kahn does. My understanding is the oversight in this regard, as outlined in 16E, but we could pull that up and take a look if staff wants to do that, is that had to do with the security issues, access issues, interface issues, issues of having a system integrity. And I would not expect that it would go to the content of the information. OET works with a number of websites throughout agencies, throughout the state government, and my understanding currently with, like, you know, for example, Deeds Positively Minnesota, while OET may have some oversight on how that's system issues and structure and all security and all those kinds of things, that the agency itself dictates the appropriate content based on their mission. But there may be others who could state more on that topic.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Bunn. I think maybe you should just figure out exactly what it means and then maybe just tighten up by adding a word or two, because I think it's a little unclear whether it's what exactly that means.
Okay.
And just in my...
Representative Kahn.
It's not unclear at all if you read 16A. Just read it in. Read 16A. Specifically refers to architecture, security, accessibility, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Not content.
And it's also specifically, we usually, 16E usually kicks in, because 16E refers to the fact that finance will not let loose any appropriation unless they've checked all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
But what's started to concern me is the existence of these private networks, because they're not trigger 16E isn't being triggered by having an appropriation. You need to do something to make sure mm-hmm. that it's triggered.
Representative Kahn, so that means authority then is defined, and I can go look now, but authority is defined in Chapter 16E, what authority means then? Or?
Oh, yeah, I mean, okay. That's set out section by section in 16E.
Okay, I'll review that then.
Okay, any further discussion? Well, seeing none then, Representative Kahn renews her motion that Senate File 2758, the first unofficial committee engrossment, be recommended to pass as amended and placed on the general register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senate File 1537, Representative Clark.
Mr. Chair.
And Representative Hilty, maybe while she's coming forward, if you want to move the division report.
I would, Mr. Chair, move adoption of the Energy Policy and Finance Division Report for Senate File 1537, the first unofficial committee engrossment.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Clark, would you care to move the bill?
Great. My hands on it. Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment that I'd like to have the committee put on.
Yeah, why don't you move the bill first?
Okay, yes. I will move that the bill be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, the motion is before us, and then, as you mentioned, there's an author's amendment that would put the bill in the form that you would like. So, Representative Clark, is that the A6 amendment?
It is.
Okay. Representative Clark moves the A6 amendment to get the bill in the form that she would like. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Clark on the bill as amended then.
Thank you, members. And Mr. Chairman, this bill has been through the process within Representative Hilty's committee, and it actually went to the floor. And we brought it back because we added to it a portion of a bill that is also passing in the Senate. The first part of the bill that deals with the certificate of need being required for the high voltage transmission line that Xcel Energy is proposing to put through actually the neighborhood that I live in South Minneapolis, and actually the neighborhood, the densest neighborhood actually in the whole state. Anyway, the proposal to have a certificate of need has been, as I mentioned, passed on the Senate floor, and we had this on the floor, and this went through this committee before, but it's now back because we are adding language that requires a neighborhood energy reduction report and study to be done. Mr. Chair, that is in another bill in the Senate, Senator Anderson's bill. And the amendment that we put on today just recognizes a few concerns that the Department of Commerce had. We met with them yesterday, and I think the bill is now in really good shape. It has no objections from Excel, and there's a letter, I believe, that you have in your packet. With that, we've met with them numerous times with community in the community and over here to talk about what would work between the utility and the neighborhood. And you can look at that letter, and basically what we're doing in the rest of this bill then is developing a community steering committee that would help guide the process of looking at two things. One, is it possible to come up with enough energy saving conservation opportunities in the neighborhood, and two, to look at renewable energy opportunities to help reduce the demand that's the basis for the proposed transmission line. We don't know the answer to that. The study will look at that, and we'll see whether or not that can happen. Right now, this particular transmission line is proposed to run right down the Greenway in South Minneapolis, and there's a lot of concern in the neighborhood about disruption of economic development, health and safety issues, and a number of other concerns. And we believe that what we have before us is a process that will work. It has the support, as I mentioned, of the community, and Excel has signed off on it, and we are there's a whole process going forward parallel to this with the Department of Commerce that looks at the routing, and we've of the possible routing, proposed routing of the transmission line. They're looking at such issues as should it go down another street, a couple other streets in the neighborhood, could it be put underground. Those are the kinds of issues that are being discussed. And the way we've structured this bill, it works in tandem with that, so that the process and the dates have been modified and changed so that they complement each other and that we will be able to go forward by 2013.
You referenced, Representative Clark, the letter being in. We didn't get the letter, so. Oh.
There's a copy here.
Okay. There's copies to be distributed then for members. Okay.
And I think, I don't know if you have in your packet letter.
Not that the information you weren't providing was accurate, just that you referenced the
letter. Sorry. And there's a number of letters from community organizations, churches, and others in the neighborhood. I don't know if that made it into your packet today or not. It didn't. Okay.
So this is the letter people are now receiving. Okay, any discussion on the bill? Representative Paymer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clark, I talked to you briefly about the bill yesterday. I'm glad you're doing this, but I didn't see the bill until today, and I can't offhand see anything that's problematic regarding my city, yours, one of the Twin Cities. And but you are including cities of the first class, and I'm just wondering if you talked with anybody from St. Paul, just trying to think through how this potentially could impact some of the transmission lines along the Mississippi River. St. Paul has probably as many bike paths as Minneapolis does, and I have no clue, but I just don't know if you checked it out with anybody from my city.
Mr. Chairman, I relied on our research staff. We asked them to craft it so it would only apply to this particular transmission line, and the points that they make in there about 8,000 persons per square mile. Again, this is right through the heart of the city. It's not along some bike path by a river somewhere. It has Mr. Eloff, like maybe is he here?
Yeah.
Can perhaps explain, you know, the detail to which he went, because we were very concerned just to have it limited to this neighborhood. Maybe we could ask him to just verify that.
Mr. Eloff.
Bobby Eloff, House Research. Members, this was drafted, as Representative Clark mentioned, using the information that she had given me about where this line was going and what the study area she wanted to have. So there are, you've got city to first class within a mile of transmission line. You've got the population density, which I think, as Representative Clark indicated, is unlikely to be reproduced anywhere else in Minnesota. The below-grade bike path and other walking paths along the river, I mean, there are 7 or 8 different factors in here that I think make this a unique area that is not going to be reproduced with these characteristics anywhere else in the state.
Representative Paymar.
Well, Mr. Chair, that may be true. I don't know that in St. Paul's a city of the first class. There's bike paths in the downtown area of St. Paul. I don't know if the population density exceeds 8,000. But Representative Clark, just as the bill goes forward to Ways and Means, if you could check with my city and just make sure there's no impact here, I appreciate it.
I'd be glad to do that. Representative Paymar, just if you provide me with the best person, the name of the best person to call, I'll be glad to do that.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative House.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Clark, on page 2, line 32, stipends for child care and transportation. Do we have any other statute on record or anywhere that we pay for babysitting?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hall, yes, we do. I know because of years ago offering those kinds of amendments to various bills. And I can't tell you right now for sure, but it's expenses sometimes. We pay for expenses and per diem and transportation, that sort of thing. One of the things to know here is that in a community like this community, this is it's the inner city, but it's also a wider area in South Minneapolis. And one of the things is you might get the people who can pay for child care or pay for a babysitter to come, but those who are most lower income and really could be a barrier. We had to come up in one meeting. That's why we put it in. One person could not attend who was very knowledgeable, lived right near where the line is, an alternative place where the line is projected to go. And she could not attend because she didn't have child care that day. There are issues like that come up in an inner city in a low-income neighborhood that we are trying to meet here. And I know that they've been in other statutes. I can't cite them for you right now, but if you need us to do that, we can sure do a survey and find out.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Howell.
Representative Clark, I was born and raised in Minneapolis. I know Minneapolis quite well. I don't recall in my growing up years that my parents ever had to get somebody to babysit me while they went to a neighborhood meeting, but I don't know. It just hits me the wrong way. If people are going to be involved with things and they really have a passion for it, if they want to be involved, I think they can figure it out without the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota paying for them to go to a meeting. So I can't vote for it.
Mr. Chairman, would you be more comfortable if it just said expenses? I mean, the statute does say expenses in many cases, and I don't know that they're always delineated.
Representative Clark, I think I'll just be a very quiet no and we'll let it go.
Because of the child care.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, what is the, on 16C, are we referring to that? I think it's under 16C. I lost that number.
Mr. Eloff, I think you can help me on that.
Is that a conflict of interest or? Oh, it's on the amendment of the draft that adopted. One-time appropriation, Chapter 16C, governing the process of entering into technical and professional services, do not apply to that. And I'm wondering, what are we having an exception for that in this amendment?
Mr. Yeo.
It's on the amendment.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and members, yes, this language exempts this appropriation from provisions in that chapter that have certain procedural requirements for letting these contracts out, referring to
Mr. Chair, maybe our legal counsel can help us with this a little bit. For Mr. Mark or somebody. We're creating an exemption to 16C, the governing process. I want to know what the exemption is.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I think the main exemptions we're talking about are publicizing the availability of this contract and also competitive bidding mechanisms.
Mr. Chairman, I might mention Representative Solberg. This was a request from the Department of Commerce. This whole amendment before us here is all requests from the Department of Commerce.
Well, I want to have an understanding of what that is before I feel comfortable with it. It may be something that's fine, you know, the department needs, but I just want to know what they're exempting from.
Let's,
we could ask maybe.
I mean, if that's a specific question of the department, let's have them come down and tell us why the exemption is needed. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, I'm Bill Glahn, Deputy Commissioner of Commerce and Director of the Office of Energy Security. And yes, Mr. Chair and members, Representative Solberg, we did ask specifically for this language. And again, I'm not familiar with everything that's in 16C, but we specifically wanted to be exempt from the requirement to do competitive bidding on this. We understand that the there was a specific organization in mind for this to go through the competitive bidding process, as Mr. Eloff described, you know, with the public notice and the RFP issuance and the reviewing proposals. It would add a considerable amount of time at the front end of this process, cutting into the amount of time available to the grantee for conducting the study. And since the due date, if I recall correctly, was February 15th, we didn't have a lot of time to work with. So if we went through the competitive bidding process and the normal course of things, this group has a pretty ambitious scope of work they need to undertake in the bill, and we thought time was of the essence. So that's why we asked for that specific exemption. We weren't trying to get, I don't know what else is in there, we weren't trying to get out of anything else, but specifically the competitive bidding requirement.
Representative Solberg, you say?
Well, at least I understand what the exemption is. I may not feel comfortable with the exemption, but we would have they can share with us, you know, what the intent is. Is there a specific company or process that does this? I thought the main thing is the professional and technical services were not necessarily open to competitive bidding, but there has some RFP standards anyway.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, you may well be correct. We just wanted to make it clear that we didn't want to have any dispute further down the line, that we didn't go through the process, because it was, again, my understanding that the proponents of the bill have one or more organizations specifically in mind that they would like to see do this work, and we want to make it clear that that we're trying to work with the proponents from the community to try to get them going as quickly as possible and not get hung up in the administrative. I understand your concern, and if you don't think that's appropriate, then we'll abide by that if that's the decision. But we were trying to think of obstacles that would sit in the way of getting this work done by the due date, and that was one that we identified as a potential obstacle.
Thank you.
Got a follow-up question to that. When you say the due date, it's in August. What competitive bidding would take longer between, let's say, the end of the session, and it might even pass sooner than that? But what was the date of enactment here? I guess that was the
Mr. Chair, the date line 3.10. It's effective immediate or the day following final enactment.
That's what I thought I recalled. So the question is, you know, that's several months from now. What kind of timeline does it take for competitive bidding?
Mr. Chair, I'm sure could try to do it as quickly as possible, but, you know, there's a few weeks would be lost in there, I would guess, maybe up to a month.
Would be lost from the August, would take into September, is that what you're saying?
Well, following enactment,
I just don't know how long it takes for the competitive bidding process. That's my question. And if this were enacted, well, it's technically day after final enactment, but let's assume that by the time we go through the process, it's mid-May. Would it take from mid-May till August to go through a competitive bidding process?
No, Mr. Chair. I would think 30 days to go through the process. I would try to do it as quickly as possible if we did that, given that time is of the essence. But there's some period of time to issue the RFP. We have to
we could draft the RFP between now and May 15th, I would suppose, and issue it as quickly as we could following enactment. We need to give folks out there some amount of time to respond to it. But, you know, again, no matter what process we follow, if we did a direct negotiation with a vendor, that would take time as well. So in the end, maybe we're picking up a week or two from this. It's probably not the biggest time savings in the world, but we're trying to shave off as much time as we could to give whoever is the grantee a fighting chance to get done by the due date.
Representative Coles.
Well, maybe a bit of a follow-up to your questions, Mr. Chair, and Representative Solberg's questions. Representative Clark, I mean, is this an earmark for a particular organization to do the study? And if so, who?
Mr. Chairman, Clark. At this point, we do not have a particular organization in mind. We started out this bill and it passed through Representative Hilty's committee with a particular organization. But in the meantime, that organization felt that the scope was too big for them and the funding not sufficient. So we are in the process right now of looking at several other opportunities. We've been meeting with different people who are considering doing the work. It takes some expertise in terms of looking at energy efficiency and renewable energy, and so I think part of the issue with this RFP was that we were told it would be 2 to 3 months. Now, I haven't heard this short of a distance time before, but nevertheless, didn't come from me. It came from the department. So it's not at this point, Representative Cole, anything specific, but we want it to be a credible agency that can really do the work, and we'll work with the neighborhood and work with the Commerce Department, work with the Excel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll save the rest of my questions on that for later. One other question, though, Representative Clark, or maybe a concern, and if you could respond to the concern, I'd appreciate it. Are we setting up a situation where in the future, going forward, we will have communities coming forward saying, this is what's unique about my community, my area, and this is why we need to do another study, a different study, change the way that we do this process and have historically done the process? And are we subjecting this to a new level of, I guess, involvement from politicians, legislators, maybe appropriately so, but are we setting up a new situation where, if I come forward and I'm a member of the minority here, and maybe I'm not quite as successful in getting my bill through through the process, and I'm not able to, get the issues that some of my constituents have concerns about presented, are we creating a different standard for different parts of the state, or depending on either who their representative is or who, how dense the area is, or how rural it is, or whatever the case may be? Are we creating a new standard, or a different standard, or at least the precedent for the next legislator to come forward with at the next project and cause new issues for whoever the utility may be that's looking to site a transmission line?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cole, I hope we are creating a certain kind of precedent, which is working with the utility to address a specific issue that is exempted by current law that probably should not be, and I think the utility can speak for themselves, but I think they've come to believe that a certificate of need was a very good idea to have put in place with this law. It was exempted because the language of the existing law says that you have to only do a certificate of need if you have a 10-mile transmission line that you're proposing. That's fine in areas that are, rural, like where I grew up. There's not a lot of people living around there. This is an area that's extremely densely populated, the most densely populated in the whole city. Lots of children. The places where they were proposing to do it would have been very disruptive to the whole economic development of the area. It's along a bike path, a historic railroad line. There were many, many issues that came up, issues of liability for insurance, things that couldn't be built, people's property values being soaring down because of what could happen from this. And so there's been a lot of negotiation with the neighborhood and with Excel. They've come to numerous meetings in the neighborhood, and we came to this, I think, this approach at this time because, yes, there is a specialty when you propose to put something that hasn't been done for more than 50 years through the heart of a city, through the heart of an extremely dense, low-income, majority community of color neighborhood. You're going to put these high-voltage transmission lines. And the thing is, it serves a much wider area, but they're only going to put it through this one neighborhood. So, yes, I think it does raise, you know, hopefully, a really good process for how people can work together when there are, when there is, you know, some of these critical issues being raised. And I think we shouldn't be afraid of that. And Excel has not been particularly afraid of it either. That's why we have an agreement to work together on this.
Well, Mr. Chair, clearly there's not an agreement, at least not one that can be done without without legislation. And so I guess the concern that I have is that, you know, depending on who's, you know, who's in charge, who has the ability to get a bill through the process, you know, you may be able to hold a utility to a higher or lower standard if you're able to get legislation through the process. I'm not sure, Representative Clark, given... you know, given the history around here the last couple of years, that if this were in my district and I had some of these concerns, that I would have as much success as you've had. And, you know, kudos to you for getting your bill through the process. But I guess I've got some concerns about whether we're creating a new political politicized process that is going to make each and every project now something that the utilities are going to have to come to the legislature for to deal with some new wrinkle on what is the existing standard for getting these lines sited. So that's the concern I have. I guess I'll continue to take a look at the bill and think about it. I understand what you're doing. I've got some real concerns about the precedent we're setting.
Representative Champion.
Representative Clark, you and I have always agreed on many different things, and this bill is no exception. But I would call your attention to the amendment, especially when we look at 16C. 16C is not just a competitive process. It's also the inclusion provision, especially when there are state funds that are used. When you think in terms of the Department of Administration, they look at 16C in order to get guidance when we think in terms of including targeted group businesses. And as of March 16, 2010, there was a disparity study that was done that talked extensively about the statistical disparities amongst certain identified groups. And one of the things that I've been pushing a lot is not to sacrifice inclusion and fostering inclusion for women and people of color and other communities as well. And so what I'm a little challenged by, and I hope that you all would think about it in real time, is whether it is a good guiding principle for us to extract from this process the need to really look at 16C when we're looking at state funds. So 16C is that guidance. You can look specifically at 16C.08. You can also look at 16C.16, which talks specifically to it. So when you exempt out 16C as a whole, you are exempting out this guiding principle of inclusion. And so I would like for you to respond to that, and I would hope that you would, you know, take it to heart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Champion. You know, you might be right that it should be more specifically delineated to the point that's trying to be governed there, because you're right, we do agree on the need to be inclusive, and so I can be working on that with you if you'd like to make it more specific. I don't think we'll have any problem with meeting the inclusion in this community with that a little more carefully crafted.
I think Representative Solberg wants to do a follow-up to this question relative to 16C. Representative Solberg.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't understand all the implications of 16C, but with the testimony that was given, that there seemed to be a discrepancy between one committee versus without doing that, it would take 3 months delay as opposed to 2 or 3 weeks delay that we heard today. I would feel more comfortable at least having that removed from the bill. Exemption. So, with the author's permission,
I'm fine with that, Mr. Chair.
Hopefully, I'm not causing harm to the bill with the Department of Commerce. I would like to remove the lines 1.10 to 1.13 in the amendment A6.
Okay, that motion.
But wait a second. Wait. Well, someone else help me out on it. No, not all of it. Just, I'm sorry. I need to leave that first sentence in there of that. So starting on line 1.11, after the period, delete the rest of that, and line 1.12 and 1.13. I'll get it right, I guess.
Mm-hmm. is that staff that works then the way he's now presented it? Okay, the motion is before us then to on line 1.11 after the word extended in the period, strike the following sentence through line 1.13.
And Mr. Chairman, with the caveat to this, if the department comes and says that they absolutely need it and need it in a more narrow fashion of some section of that, I would be willing to revisit that as well.
I'm fine with that, Mr. Chair. I support the motion.
And that kind of goes to the question, Representative Clark, that I was asking, what, you know, being that the bill would be enacted day after final enactment, and that means that the latest it would be probably mid to late May, and maybe even earlier, depending on how quickly we get it through the process, and we are working with the Senate file. So with that, any discussion on the amendment? If seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Okay, so further discussion. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Clark, I've got a few problems with this bill. I'm not sure why we have different standards for metro and rural or suburban. I'm wondering if I'm trying to kind of visualize this in my head, and I'm not sure if this would be a question for Excel. I'm looking at the first page, and it talked to obviously about a very specific location, below grade bike and walking path. I'm not real sure what that area looks like and how close that is to homes. But I guess I'm wondering specifically, and this, I guess this would be a question for Excel if you would allow it. I'm wondering what the power needs are, why this project is being pushed forward, and the timing, because the report looks like it wouldn't even be due until February 15th of next year, putting this on more. So is there a need? What's the power situation there? Are you having a hard time getting the capacity they need there? Worry about getting brownouts or anything like that, or I'm kind of trying to figure out what the need is, because it seems like this is, you know, basically just a way to kill the project, and I'm wondering if the people in that community are going to like to go without energy, if that might be the case. So maybe you could just comment on that.
I think you're with Excel, if I recall, so if you could answer. You heard the question.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And if you could identify yourself.
Members, I'm Rick Evans with Excel Energy. This story really starts with a great success story, and the success story is Lake Street, Chicago Avenue, Hiawatha, the Midtown area of Minneapolis, where there has been tremendous economic development, new Sheraton Hotel, the Alina headquarters, the Wells Fargo mortgage building, the Sears building that was converted to a marketplace, I guess, and the plans for the future call for high-density residential to be continue to be developed in the area. So in answer to the question, yes, there has been a significant growth in the load, in the energy needs in that area. And this power line is planned for the purpose of delivering that energy. One of the important dates in the bill is that the certificate of need process needs to start by April 1st. And that was intended so that it can be completed in time. The real critical deadline is that the line has to be in service before the summer peak season of 2013. So we think that the times that have been set forth in this bill are sufficient to allow us to continue this process and have the community input and still get the line built in time to serve the need. But it is a critical need, and it is very time sensitive. We've worked with Representative Clark and appreciate her work to make sure that we think the time will work now under the parameters of this bill.
Thank you. I have a follow-up question probably for both of you. I'm looking at the fiscal note, and it says the cost is $307,000 something, and I understand that's going to be an assessment that you would pay to pay for this, so it's not directly coming out of our general fund, is my understanding. Maybe you can clarify that. And I'm wondering, where would that money come from? How would you pay for that? Would that come directly from ratepayers?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, your both assumptions are correct. That would not come from the general fund. That would come from an assessment of Xcel Energy. And yes, that would be a cost that that we could build into our base rate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Evans, you may not have this off the top of your head. Do you have any idea of what that might be, an average increased cost per consumer? And maybe you could provide that later, because I'm guessing you probably don't have that off on the top of your head.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't have the number off my head. I'd have to say for the $300,000+ it would be perhaps too small to be measured. I mean, it would be a very small amount.
But perhaps with all the other mandates that have been put on, small amounts start to add up. Anyway, thank you very much.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Evans, would there be the opportunity to assess only the area where the need is and where the project is being delayed because of this legislation?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have the technology to assess only the ratepayers in the area where the need is and where the project will be delayed because of this legislation?
Mr. Chair, I don't know whether we have the technology. We don't have the process or the practice of doing that.
Seeing no further.
Chairman?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry. The one question that I have in reading on page 3 has to do with energy savings. I'm kind of getting the impression from reading all of this together that the author, Representative Clark, you may be thinking that there would be enough energy savings to maybe not need this project. And for you, my question would be, might that be the case that you're thinking that might be the situation? And from Mr. Evans, do you have some background studies, because your goal is out to 2013, that includes energy savings that would also contribute to the question regards to, again, based on the need, and would energy savings make up the difference between the need and the projected circumstance? So it's a question really for both of you.
Mr. Chairman, I think you asked me first, Representative Kiffmeyer. Whether or not this could obviate the need, they still deserve credit for the energy savings. That's part of the way we work with our utilities right now. But what I want to say is I don't know for sure the answer to that question. I would guess not just from energy savings. That would be the best advice I've gotten. But that energy savings plus renewable energy could get closer to helping reduce the need. And I don't know if it would reduce the whole need. I think the utility thinks it's impossible. I think others, experts that we've talked to, think, well, it hasn't really been explored. If, for example, some of the larger facilities in our neighborhood put photovoltaic cells on their rooftop, there are numerous kinds of things that people think could make a difference. I can tell you one thing. This is a neighborhood with very old housing that leaks energy like crazy. We need to do some of the things that I think the utility, Xcel and others, have really supported over the years, which is to invest in some retrofitting of our houses with insulation, windows that are leaky. There's things that can be repaired, many things that consumers can do to cooperate and be part of reducing the energy costs in the neighborhood. But I don't know fully the answer to your question. That's what the study is about. We're going to find out what difference it can be made. And I think what you're looking at, the section you're looking at in the bill, basically says that the utility gets credit for that. And that is an existing kind of mechanism that's already there. So we're just going to continue that and make sure that they do get that credit. Maybe Mr. Evans wants to respond.
No, Mr. Chairman. I also wanted to hear from Mr. Evans on the same subject.
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think Representative Clark represented our position pretty well. We do have extensive experience in conservation. We have, I think, the best conservation program in the country. We work very hard on it. We will work very hard in this neighborhood. We also, I think, know more about renewable energy than most people in the country. Based on our best judgment, it is never going to be possible to find sufficient savings in the neighborhood to eliminate the need for this line. But good will come out of trying. We'll find other conservation measures, and so I don't think the money spent on it is wasted. It will be spent to find other renewable and conservation measures in the neighborhood. the chances of this eliminating the need for the line are, I think, very, very, very small, which is why we need to make sure we maintain the integrity of the dates in the bill so that, that if they are unable to eliminate the need for the line, we can still get the line built in time.
Mr. Chairman, just as a just as a follow-up comment, general experience has said while you conservation helps delay that, if at the same time you are increasing the need and you have development and you have other things going on, those two compete with each other, and usually that increased demand ends up also contributing. Conservation is something we should do anyway. We shouldn't waste no matter what, but I don't think that it I think the timeline of, especially in that area, the increased development and all of that is going to contribute more to the need going down the line than the savings I think we'll be able to do. But I think, like you said, Mr. Evans, certainly the effort to try and, as Representative Clark said, will be valuable. So thank you very much for your time.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, then Representative Clark renews her motion that House File 1537, the first unofficial committee engrossment, be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. We'll now go down to...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
You're welcome. And next item on the agenda is House File 3790 by Representative Murphy. And Representative Murphy, if you'd care to move the division report. Oh, there is no division. That's right. It was introduced as a committee bill and referred to finance. So we simply need a motion then that the bill be recommended to pass.
Mr. Chairman, I move that House File 3790 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, the motion is before us, and it's my understanding that you have an author's amendment, the A2 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And this would put the bill in the way you'd like to present it?
That's correct. This is a technical amendment in Article 1 that would allow Wild Rice Lakes to be protected and managed.
Okay, the motion is before us then. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. And let's see, that's all the author's amendments. So
that's correct, Mr.
We do have some other amendments, but I think we'll have you present the bill and then we'll...
Other amendments?
we have one, A1 amendment by Representative
Mr. Chair.
Shocked and dismayed. Okay.
If members of the committee, represent my vice chair, Representative Morgan is here today, too, and so he's...
And welcome, Representative
going
Morgan.
To take care of those amendments. Anyway, Mr. Chair, members, this is a committee bill that was adopted by our committee after many long hours of... deliberation and understanding and questioning. There are three major bills that are contained in this House File 3790. And Article 1 is completely all the recommended appropriations from the Lassard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council. And Article 2 comes from the House File 3502, which was first heard and changed in Representative Wiginius's Committee on Environment Finance, and it has completely to do with clean water. And House File 3258 is the basis for Article 3, which was a Representative Beard bill, which has to do with legislative auditors' audits of the funds. the information that's contained in the bill, or the issues that are contained in the bill, are only the issues that came before the committee that in our responsibility of oversight of the constitutional amendment funds that were passed in November of 2008. And they only have to do with the constitutional established funds, the Outdoor Heritage Fund, the Parks and Trails Fund, the Clean Water Fund, and the Arts, History, and Culture Fund. I think it's important to note that in Article 1, all of the funding levels that were recommended by the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council are being recommended for appropriation in this bill. There are technical policy changes that incorporate some of the suggestions that were made to our committee and concerns raised that were made to our committee. And we think that the few, very few, changes made a better bill. We are making it clear in this document, 3790, that we are selecting the highest quality programs and using established criteria as the top priority in making grants. And when other things are equal, other criteria could be established. We are ensuring that the DNR provides sign-off to land purchases and permanent easements in writing. And we recognize that sometimes there are additional projects that include both acquisition and enhancement and restoration that may require more time than was originally planned or granted. And so we extended the time that funding is available to accomplish the enhancement and restoration. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we had adequate time to develop this bill. And we took it. We had two opportunities for the public or for any groups that had concerns to come before us. And we considered their input and included some of what they said in the bill. That concludes my remarks, Representative Morgan.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to add that we commend the work of the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. Representative Hansen carried the recommendations for appropriations from that council to our committee. The chair of the Lessard-Sams Council, Dr. Kilgore, and the executive director, Mr. Becker, sat before our committee, I think, over 2 days. It was 5 or 6 hours, and we thoroughly vetted the bill. Asked a lot of good questions, got a lot of great feedback, and much of that feedback is what guided the changes that we did make to the bill. Again, emphasizing what the chair said, we did not change any of the appropriations, just some of the language behind it, which we think will improve the bill. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess we'll sit for questions.
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I'm just curious about on page 14, because I don't understand how this works. Maybe I should, but the Legislative Coordinating Commission, the $600,000 that is appropriated to the council for compensation and expenses, so, how much money do the council members make? How much are they compensated for? Maybe that's the... or what is their compensation rate? Maybe a
Mr.
better
Chair, point. I'll call on Representative Hansen, who is a member of the council and the author of the bill.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Paymar, staff are getting the budget, the 2011 budget, available for you. Council members receive per diem. And do you have copies? Council members receive per diem and then mileage and lodging for meals. The council, if for example, the full council hasn't met since January. There was an executive committee meeting last week. If someone came in for that executive committee meeting, they would get the $77 a day. If they are House members or House appointees, they get the Senate per diem if they were Senate appointees or Senate per Senate members. And then their mileage and lodging. The estimated expenses for July 1st, 2010 to June 30th, 2011 are member per diem $15,420, outstate meeting rental $2,000, member meals $3,710, member lodging $6,670, member trip lodging $4,000, member mileage $14,700, coach rental for trips $3,000, parking $2,000, a total of $51,500 for meeting expenses. Staff expenses are about $311,000. Interns, staff development, staff meals, mileage, and lodging is $23,400. And then there are about $37,000 in office expenses. There would be costs of professional technical services during the fiscal year of $125,000 for the management analysis division for a 25-year planning consultant and $45,000 for project evaluation for a total professional and technical services of $170,000. And the details should be in your hands shortly, if not already.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. And can you explain lines 4.22 to 14.22 to 14.27?
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Paymar, that section was debated last year in the bill. The intent of that section was when there are site visits similar to what the LCCMR, if there are members that are on the bus, they could, that would not be an open meeting when they're traveling and receiving information. I believe, Representative Murphy, that was an issue in the conference committee last year, and the House side did not have that in, and the House side did not prevail in the conference committee.
Representative Paymar.
And Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, that is a question that came up, and it was one of the recommendations to be changed by one of our citizen members, or not members, but one of the citizens that responded to the bill in public testimony brought that issue up, and we are still gathering additional information from other groups on how they handle the bus ride.
Mr. Chair, could you just say that one more time? I don't understand what's happening there. So there's an issue about whether there's actually meetings taking place on the bus. Is that what and whether that's subject to the open meeting law? Is that?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Representative Paymar.
And so, Mr. Chair, so this excludes those meetings from the open meeting law, and apparently there's an issue that that's problematic. Is that from some? I mean, I don't understand how the whole issue came up.
It came up because of Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, it came up because there were people concerned with the language on lines 1422 to 28. They were saying that if there was business transacted, it should be open to the public. And that if people are traveling on a bus, then it's not open to the public because you can't run along the side of the bus with the windows open and they hear what's going on. And if the bus is full, they can't bring anybody else on. Or it was suggested by another person that we should have in that language that says there shall be no business conducted in traveling to and from a site. Then there's been there were other examples presented where a lot of information can be presented on a bus. Someone can get on a bus and make a presentation and get off the bus at the next stop, and people will have not, so to speak, wasted that time because they've learned, they spent time listening and stopping in that information, and then when they get to a public place, they could perhaps have their votes and discussion about the language that was presented to them. But we haven't, that did not come early enough for us to debate whether we were going to change that or not.
Representative Paymar. No. Further discussion? Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair and members, in Article 3, Sections 1 and 2, I understand the reason for it, and I have support the Legislative Audit Commission conducting these particular studies. I am a little concerned that we are establishing in this a statutory appropriation so that it continues going on and on. I don't know how else to do it, I suppose, but it would be nice to have a direct appropriation amount in this particular proposal. And I noticed on the spreadsheet that it does say that the Outdoor Heritage Fund audit is $66,000 and the parks $36,000 this fiscal year. And then it continues on into the next fiscal years as well. Maybe the question is there a reason we're not doing actual appropriation for that if the amount is suggested to be $66,000 instead of having an open appropriation, a statutory appropriation?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Noble from the Legislative Auditor's Office is here, and we've discussed that with him, and we are continuing discussions.
Mr. Nobles,
Mr. Chairman,
you'll introduce yourself.
Members, Jim Nobles, Legislative Auditor. Let me just give you a very quick context for this. When the constitutional amendment was passed, some new audit responsibility came to the Office of Legislative Auditor, and we are very excited to start doing that work. It's going to be complex and challenging, but we are committed to doing it and doing it as thoroughly as we possibly can. One possibility, of course, would be that we simply take on this additional work and then have to prioritize and not do other audits. I would just quickly remind members that we have responsibility to audit the state's financial statements. We audit the state's use of federal funds. Both of those audits occur every year. We're mandated by law to do them. We have jurisdiction and responsibility to then audit about 160 other entities and have to create a schedule to do that. So at some point, something's got to give. There are members of the Legislative Audit Commission that would like us to receive some additional money over time for this additional work on the legacy funds. I personally am indifferent to how it is accomplished. My original proposal was that we, at least in the current biennium, receive no additional money, that we simply be allowed to use our existing carry forward, and we have some because we have a significant amount of turnover in the office and we've accumulated some amount of carryover. My original proposal, which was drafted into legislation and introduced, would not have appropriated any additional money to the legislative auditor from any source. But there is, I think, sensitivity among some members that this function of auditing the legacy funds should not be borne by the general fund, and our carry-forward money would be general fund money. This is really an issue for you as legislators to sort out. I, again, am indifferent as to which pot of money you use to pay for this work. What you have in front of you was prepared by fiscal staff and House Legal Counsel. It is an alternative to what I originally proposed because, again, there was some sensitivity about using carry forward and general fund money to doing this work. I would simply add as a final point that this is clearly something that's going to have to be negotiated in the conference committee. The Senate has a totally different position. They reject the idea of using legacy money for this audit work and prefer that the legislative auditor be funded fully out of general fund money. Again, I leave it to you to sort out. We will do the work, whether you give us any more money or not. It is our responsibility, and we will do it. You need to sort out how you want to pay for it.
Mr. Chair,
Solberg.
Representative and the auditor, I think misconstrued my question, and probably it isn't even a question for the auditor. It is for the chair of the committee or others. And that is, I support the provisions to have the money come from the funds. I have a difficult time having an open and standing appropriation. And when we have that the cost is estimated to be $66,000 and $36,000 for the functions this year, then why are we allowing an open and standing appropriation to continue on? Why are we not... either maybe Representative Wagenius just appropriating that money from the fund directly so we know how much it's being appropriated.
Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, we discussed the entire topic at our committee meeting, and one of the items that Representative Wagenius brought to our attention was the because of the deficits that we were carrying, the general cutting back that we were having to do with the agencies under the Environment Finance Committee and how much they were getting cut back. And it seemed to be the will of the conversation in our committee that the environmental funds should pay for the audits that were for the projects. And so, but also what Auditor Noble said was that we knew that this was going to be a continued discussion for the conference committee.
Mr. And Chairman,
we did not choose to have a hard and fast solution to go into that discussion.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, I support having this fund pay for the audit because I think that's very much an appropriate cost of the fund. We should not transfer it to the general fund. But my question is, it says the on 37.6, the amount required to make these payments is appropriated from each fund. And yet on the spreadsheet, it says $66,000 and $36,000 from those two funds. Why are we not saying then if it costs, if the projected cost is $66,000, we have in a fiscal note to some kind or somehow or another it's on the spreadsheet, why are we not saying that the $66,000 is appropriated from that and $36,000 from the other, so we have a specific amount?
Mr. Chairman, I think I can answer that. And again, we have taken this approach because it was recommended by fiscal and House legal staff. And I think the logic behind it is that we are entering into a 25-year venture here with the legacy funds and the responsibility of the legislative auditor to audit those. You also, the legislature, has required us to audit the Outdoor Heritage Fund expenditures every other year. So we have a mandate to do that over a 25-year period, and I think there's an interest on the part of the legislature having us audit the other three funds on that same cycle. So I think it's attempting to set it up as an ongoing resource with the other piece that I think has been important to some legislators, and that is that we would be required to only be reimbursed on a cost basis, that we would have to keep track of our hours, and that we would make public reports both to all the various constituencies and interest groups, and that we would base our request for reimbursement from the funds on demonstrated work related to those funds. Rather than you giving us an appropriation up front, we would have to come back through this mechanism of a report to the Commissioner of Management and Budget, demonstrate what time we have spent, what costs we have incurred, and that we would obtain no money other than a reimbursement, rather than getting an appropriation up front. That's the logic behind this proposal. But again, I would only emphasize, however you want to approach it, we will do the work.
Representative Solberg.
That's it.
Okay. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Chairman or staff, or maybe somebody around the table would know the answer to this. On page 29, starting on line 17, there's a new section added, which creates a water tax. Mr. Chair, if the governor objected to this new tax, could he line item this section out of the bill, or would his only recourse have to be to veto the entire bill?
We can ask staff. Welcome. If you'd identify yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, Mark Shepard from House Research, and Representative Biskins. Offhand, I think that the governor would not be able to line item veto this provision. This provision is a fee. It's not an item of appropriation. There, I believe that elsewhere in the bill, money is appropriated from these fee proceeds. But I may have to think about it more, but offhand, I think this would likely not be item vetoable.
Representative Kahn, I believe you have an amendment, the A1 amendment, if you'd like to move that.
Yes, I'd like to move the A1 amendment. But this is dealing with a situation that's it's just kind of putting in comfort language into the bill. What's happened is that there's a piece of an incredible piece of land available. It's actually from a former member of the legislature, Scherer Brothers Lumberyard, and they are moving out of Minneapolis, and they have a big chunk of property that goes along the river. I think it's north of the Broadway Bridge. And the plan, part of it is in the metropolitan, is in the above the falls planning process. And the part that goes along the river, they've already gotten the approval from the Metropolitan Council to use Met Council funding to the Minneapolis Park Board to acquire that. The that's about one-third of it. Two-thirds of it is probably going to go to the city for development. But the problem is Scherer Brothers wants to sell it in one lump. And the environmental analysis has been done and appraisal has been done. And the deadline for doing the whole thing is May 26th, and we're not sure the city council process can get through that in that time. So this is just comfort language to say there'll be a source of funding spread out over over 4 or 5 years or so, that there'll be a source of money there in case the city council doesn't come through with it. And it's specifically targeted for money that's supposed to go to the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board.
Representative Kahn has moved the A1 amendment. Further discussion, Representative Hausman.
And Mr. Chair, I just, for the record, wanted to have Representative Kahn address. We are not, by this amendment, establishing a new metro area regional park.
No, we're not at all. We're just adding we're adding the part that the park board wants to keep is part of an existing metropolitan area regional park, also part of a national park, by the way. And the other part, which is the amount of money we're looking at, is about, I think, $1.5 million, in fact, spread over 5 years. It's just that the Minneapolis, it's not even the city council, it was kind of the staff agency, started putting delays in about asking for their independent appraisal and independent environmental assessment and so forth. And so this is just to make sure that we don't miss that May 26th drop-dead date for the offer.
Any further discussion on the A1 amendment?
Mr. Chair, it doesn't...
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, and it doesn't mean that the Parks and Trails Board has... Trails Committee in the future has to appropriate money to the Minneapolis Park Board either. It would come from the Metropolitan Council's Parks Awards that they would break down in the Minneapolis part.
Representative Kahn.
It's not binding.
Right. So I'd move the amendment. Did I do that?
Any other discussion on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Amendment prevails. Further discussion? Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this has also to do with the section on the new water tax on 2917 through 2933. Please, if you would just confirm for me, the Hennepin County is listed here, and so is Ramsey County. My understanding, though, is that St. Paul, Minneapolis use above-ground water, the Mississippi in particular, so they would not be subject to this fee. Is that correct?
Representative Murphy?
Representative
Wagenius.
Representative Kiffmeyer, this is strictly a user fee, so anyone using the water would pay the fee, and anyone not using the water does not pay the fee. You are correct that St. Paul and Minneapolis are actually different because St. Paul uses a mixture of water, but Minneapolis uses river water, highly polluted river water, that has to be processed. So we do not use the aquifer. If we did, we would drain it, and that's why it's just one of those. It's just one of those things. We don't use the aquifer, and it's probably best for everybody else that we don't, because we would take much too much water out.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it's just that I object to this. And it's based more on the fact that my county in particular, when this whole 3/8% was passed, we all pay that. And I remember the advertising, clean water, clean water. And I think if there is anything that people expected this to be used for, it would be for things like this and not have to pay on top of that. So I object to this strongly because I just think you already have the money to use for these kinds of projects. That's what the extra was for. And now to pile on this especially, I think, is an unnecessary and actually, you know, not. I look at all of this land being purchased. I have a consideration also in this bill. When you have land being purchased, and I know for counties this is a particular issue for them because now it's taken off of the property tax system and the rest of the property taxpayers have to pick up that gap because it's a distribution amongst those who do pay taxes on the property in particular. So when you're buying all this land and it goes into ownership by a public body, that takes it off the tax rolls. And I know in some counties, like up in Monoman, it's a real problem because they're not left with much. And so in this bill, when the land is being purchased, is there an in lieu of tax being paid to help offset the loss to the county and reduce the burden to the rest of the property taxpayers?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, about the water. We are establishing a process for the 11-county metropolitan area to establish some monitoring projects so that we can have some idea of how it's in the future, what is going to happen with the amount of water available for various things. We are establishing a matching fund just as we have in other parts of the state, in greater Minnesota, where they have monitoring programs that local, somehow, the money for monitoring wells has to be paid with a matching fund throughout the state. In rural Minnesota, it already exists. In greater Minnesota, it already exists. For the 11-county metropolitan area, we don't have a process yet for monitoring, and so we are establishing this monitoring fund. It's a small match compared to the amount of water that is being used and the water that's being renewed. About the land, the new land that's being purchased in here, we do say that the matching funds in here have to go for projects, have to be go from 10% to 20% in the next round. Also in here, we have directed the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council to make a recommendation for next, for the fourth round, of how the local counties or the counties or the areas or the cities, the school districts would be compensated for the amount of land that's taken out of taxpayer rolls. And they're coming back with a recommendation to us on that. For the meantime, for this round of appropriations that the Lasard Outdoor, Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council's recommendations, they are being paid for, as they always have been, from the PILT proceeds. But we have talked about the issue so much that we are having a House, and we hope the Senate will participate also, research study done on alternative ways of paying for lands in lieu of taxes. And that will be coming back to the legislature at the beginning of the next legislative session.
Representative Giffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Murphy, I think certainly monitoring groundwater, that is not the issue here. It's a method of payment, and the fact that we already are paying the extra on the sales tax for this specific kind of purpose, and I think this should be covered within that and not have an additional price on top of it. Some of those other things maybe were put in place prior to the extra sales tax, but I think now we have them. That's the whole point, is so the people in my district really object to they're paying this extra, and now on top of that. So I just I think it is not so much the concept of monitoring and all of that. That's not the point. It's the method of payment, and I do object to this cost being inserted into this bill.
But there were Representative Murphy.
Oh.
All right, Representative Junkie.
Well, a number of issues are coming up, and certainly, actually, I agree with you, Representative Kiffmeyer, and I think as this, we've been talking outside, there's agriculture fees in here, too, and others that are involved with that with your farmers up there on the sand plains, too. So I agree with you, and I would suggest as this bill moves along, we're looking for some compromise language. I'm not prepared to move with anything at this committee, but by the time we get to the floor, I would suggest there'll be some further discussions on it. I also agree with what you're saying about the PILT payments and other things. And Representative Murphy, I'm glad to hear that you're looking at that. I know Representative Wagenius and I actually agree on this too. The federal government out in my area now, when they're buying land, actually add to the purchase price more money that then the counties or the townships can set aside for future tax payments. And so they take care of it up front, And they, that way, everyone understands when you buy a piece of land, there is a cost, a future cost to it. It's not just buying the land. And so I appreciate you looking at that, and I'll be anxiously awaiting your results next year, because we can't just keep buying land without understanding the costs that are involved with it. So I agree with you on that, too. More specifically, though, the question I have, Representative Murphy or anyone else that can answer it, page 24, line 17, section 2, appropriation, we're seeing $310,000 giving for rulemaking in the Department of Pollution Control. I have a number of questions. Number one, is this something the department brought, or was it established in a previous bill to go forward with rulemaking on nitrate and total nitrogen and nitrate nitrogen? That's number one. Number two, is this the first time we've done this with legacy dollars? Now actually supplanting general fund. This typically would be a general fund expense within the departments, and now we're moving over, and I guess as a fiscal chair and one that gets involved with a lot of rulemaking in agriculture and other areas, I want to understand if we're setting a precedence here. You know, we can't afford to do rulemaking, so we're going to come and grab it from this fund, when typically it's always been a general fund expense. I mean, this is their lawmaking in the department, and for them to now come and ask for this money, I find a little bit fascinating. So I'd like to know some history on it. Was this something that the legislature asked for? Was this something the department is doing on their own? They're initiating the rulemaking. To my knowledge, no rules have been published yet, so I wonder where they're even at in the process on this.
Representative Murphy or Morgan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Junkie, this came from House File 3502, and it started someplace below my committee, but it was our understanding that it was supplementing, but Representative Wagenius has additional information.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Representative Junkie, there's very little general fund money in the Pollution Control Agency anymore. It's just practically none compared to the agency. It's mainly a fee-based agency. In one of our hearings, joint hearing with the Senate sometime, and I'm not going to be able to give you the date, but between the in the interim, we had a report on the TMDLs, which we are funding from the new clean water money. And one of the questions was how they were responding to nitrogen. And they said, well, we don't have a standard yet. They were working on, they're working on a standard. We don't have a standard yet. So they were in the process of saying, well, we will solve the problem for phosphorus, and then maybe in a couple of years we'll solve the problem for nitrogen. And the committee said, wait a minute, you are doing the most expensive process we can think of. Why aren't you getting this all done at once? So when you're solving the problem for nitrogen or dissolved oxygen or the problem for sediment, having a plan that does it all at once is a lot cheaper than doing it, do one pollutant, then another, and then another. So that is where this originated from. They said they were working on it. So this is the money, just like in, it's essentially part of the TMDL process, which we are funding from the clean water money. So we have the nitrogen standard done within several years. This is half of the money that would be needed to complete it.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you for that background. Now I kind of understand where it came from. But then specifically, Representative Murphy, is this the first time we've put rulemaking money to the departments with your fund over the last couple of years? Or is this something, so is this something we can look forward to seeing more of in the future?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, we did it last year with the critical habitats.
Yeah, we've done some.
Okay. So,
Representative Junkie.
So I just want to get it clear. So this is a legitimate request that our divisions can bring to your committee to pay for rulemaking, because it's an expensive process, and we're all required within our divisions to try and figure out how to do that when it comes in bills. But Representative Wagenius, good job for you to find a place to do it with your budget. I want to make sure that others that have budgets that do rulemaking, natural resources rulemaking like agriculture, would be welcome to your committee, too, to perhaps establish some matching monies for our rulemaking process.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I would like to remind the chair of the Agriculture Committee that this committee has no funding other than what is in the Constitutional Outdoor Heritage Fund, the Clean Water Fund, the Parks and Trails Fund, and the Arts, History, and Culture Fund. I have no appropriation other than what is recommended through the Finance Committees to this committee for the expenditures of the four funds. And I yield to Representative Morgan to talk about the Constitution.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Murphy. And I think this also addresses a comment that Representative Kiffmeyer made, particularly regarding the PILT. I believe Representative Junkie, you and Representative Dill put together a proposal last year that the House considered and indeed passed that would have accounted for that PILT of taking that land off the public taking the land out of that taxpayer base. One of the issues that we've heard is a constitutional issue, because the Constitution says, the amendment that was passed says, that this money appropriated from the Outdoor Heritage Fund may only be used to restore, protect, enhance prairies, forests, wetlands, and habitat for game, fish, and wildlife. And the concern is that if we have something that specifically replaces PILT, or is a PILT-like mechanism, that it will go to schools to pay for the operation of schools, that it will go to cities to pay for public safety. And all those are important things, but it doesn't seem to match up with the language of the Constitution. And that's why we've asked Lassard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council to take a look at the Constitution, to take a look at the ongoing land management costs that exist that are protection, restoration, and enhancement for these 25 years, and to come back to us with a proposal. So that's the constitutional struggle that I'm sure all of you can appreciate that we're having with this issue. So. Thank you,
Mr.
Very much.
Chair, just a couple things. Yes, I understand that constitutional issue. That was discussed last year, and I think the language needs to be looked at and reconfigured. You know, if these become part of the purchase price, or if it's used for ongoing maintenance of that land, I think it probably will meet a constitutional test, and that's certainly what the county monies are for, is for those parcels of land. And so I think we can overcome that, but you're right, that's something we have to look at very carefully as we move forward. And then Representative Murphy, thank you for your inkle and your nod on the rulemaking monies. Certainly we do a number of natural resource-based rulemaking in the department, test wells and pesticide monitoring, all sorts of other stuff, and it's very expensive to our general fund, so we will keep that in mind as we develop budgets to move through your committee in the future. So thank you for that.
And Mr. Chairman, I did not nod.
I heard an ankle up
there. I hear what you say, Representative Junkie, and I've also, I'm sorry that Representative Solberg left, but Representative Carlson is here, and we have some internal discussions to take place about whether indeed there should be some funding for the four funds that are at the disposal of the legislature.
Well, clearly you've got that in the bill here today, so for what it's worth, thank you.
Representative Pepin.
I'll pass.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Murphy, thank you for your diligent work on this process. My question goes back to the land acquisition and the fee title of lands acquired. In reading through the bill, I notice there are several agreements are noted with entities such as the Minnesota DNR, Bowser, Nature Conservancy, Land, Minnesota Land Trust, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, and so on. In this process, is the state of Minnesota the ultimate landowner in all these acquisitions, or who will have title and management to these properties?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shemansky, hopefully the state of Minnesota is the ultimate owner, and that we have made some successor statements to that. But I am not the best person to answer that question. Representative Hansen, who's been at those conversations from the very beginning, can do a better job. But we go ahead.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shemansky, I'm going to hand out a piece that I think gives you details on that, that there are, I believe, two projects where the ultimate recipient will be the federal government. And in the committee, Representative Howes had an amendment that provided for a reversionary clause that if they were ever abandoned by the federal government, then they would revert back to the state. But you do, you see essentially two types of purchases directly to the through the Department of Natural Resources and the Board of Water and Soil Resources. The Board of Water and Soil Resources primarily easements with the other with the DNR fee title. But when the NGOs, when the non-government organizations like Pheasants Forever or Ducks Unlimited or Trust for Public Land, they have to follow the same criteria as the DNR for those acquisitions. So they may be doing the acquisition and then it goes to the state to be added to a wildlife management area. That would be an example where perhaps the NGO can move quicker on the acquisition, but they still have to follow some of the same procedures. And I believe there are folks from DNR here that could just, you know, testify that they still have to follow those same procedures.
Representative Shemansky.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I guess two statements, both by Representative Murphy and Representative Hansen, give me a little concern. One, as Representative Murphy said, talking about the ultimate fee, the title holder, she said, hopefully, the state of Minnesota. I'm a little concerned about that. And then Representative Hansen referred to some of this acquisition being turned over to the federal government. I guess my problem is that we're using Minnesota taxpayers' money and basically granting title to the federal government. I would have an objection to that whole process. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative
May I respond
Murphy.
To that? Representative Shemansky, I said that because there are some situations where we have the easement, and then there's been occasion where people have suggested that we somebody has the easement to the property, and then that we buy it. And so the easement's been paid for, and then the purchase would be paid for, and we don't want double pricing.
Representative Kahn.
I think it's clearer if, in the long run, if the state owns it, the taxpayers own it, then some other entity. That's what I meant by hopefully.
Representative Kahn.
I actually think what I said was addressed by the conversation. The issue is that I don't think by creating a new mechanism or by doing PILT for lands newly acquired with the legacy funds that we're supplanting or supplementing. It's clearly, if the land comes from that, then anything you do to the land is clearly new. So I think, and we'll get hopefully a more precise way of doing it in the future.
Representative Hackbar.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and a few questions for Representative Murphy. And back to Article 3, Section 1 and 2 that we talked about earlier about the legislative auditor. And is this something new, Representative Murphy, where a legislative auditor, from my understanding, looks at funding issues that we pass at the legislature and looks at those issues to see whether they're being the money is being spent properly in the way it should be. Now, this seems to say that the legislative auditor has some kind of expertise in natural resources, for example, that they're going to go out and they're going to look at what has been done with the money, and how are they going to know what should be done, what shouldn't be done? I know it says here that they need to hire the right scientists to do that. But how do they know who the right scientists are? And it says, and other appropriate persons. And who are the other appropriate persons? I mean, that doesn't seem to make sense to me. And I'm kind of throwing out a number of questions, Representative Murphy. Maybe I'm just making a statement, or maybe you want to comment on these when I'm done. But I have some real concern about the legislative auditor doing this kind of work in the first place. I understand that the legislative auditor wasn't even asking for the money appropriation in the first place. But I'm not sure who these people are. And Representative Murphy, was this even part of a bill? Was this the only place that this bill was heard in your committee, or was it an amendment that was put on in your committee? I think that this is a little bit of a controversial issue to only have it stuck on your bill in a committee just recently, not having gone through a process where it should have gone through Representative Pekin's committee or Representative Wagenius' committee. I have a real concern with this section of the bill, Article 3, Section 1 and 2. I think we're going to have a little bit of a problem getting that passed off the House floor. At least I intend to make it a problem.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate discussion on the issue. It originated in Representative Beard's bill, and I don't know where it came from before it came to our committee. I can't remember that part, but we gave it a thorough venting. And then the Section 1, though, it came directly in our committee.
Representative Hackbar.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wagenius.
To that point.
Representative Wagenius.
Yes, if Representative Hansen, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this is restoration audits, and I think the identical language actually came through my committee and then went to Representative Murphy's committee, so we did have an opportunity to see it in my committee, and we did that last year, but it's still live and kicking, and was sitting in Representative Murphy's committee. So we did have discussions about this. So yes, it has passed committee.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Conley, Representative Conley informs me that Section 2 Ms. Conley told me that it went through Representative Kahn's committee too before it came to mine.
Representative Hackbar.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, but were those actual bills that were in your committee that were taken up in your committee and then rolled into this bill and discussed at that time in that particular way, or was it brought as an amendment and then put in this bill? That's the connection I'm trying to make. Discussion had taken place last year and now we're just sticking it in here now, I mean, that's a little bit different situation.
Mr. Chair, Section 2 was in House File 3258.
And Mr. Chair, was that the entire bill rolled into this bill?
Yes.
Okay. Another question, Mr. Chairman, if you'd allow me. I know that early on, Representative Murphy, that we were talking about the definition issue. And we had a problem with definitions last year. And I was under the assumption that from discussions that were taking place earlier this year, that issue of definitions was going to be addressed this year in your bill. Is that in this bill now?
No.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, no, it isn't.
And Mr. Chairman, are we going to address that issue? I know that there's a number of people that have concerns about the definition. I thought that was going to be taken care of. I thought that's what you had said earlier this year.
Representative Murphy.
Excuse me a minute, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
about the definitions. What I read about the definitions on the floor of the House on the last day of session concerning the definitions that were in the bill last year. And this is the paper I read from. The definitions of protect, restore, and enhance in this bill will be reviewed and discussed by members of the Cultural and Outdoor Resources Committee, the House Natural Resources Policy and Finance Committees, and the Senate committees relating to environment and natural resources, along with the Outdoor Heritage Council in the 2009-2010 interim. The Cultural and Outdoor Heritage Outdoor Resources Committee had on their agenda in the interim at one meeting the definitions enhance, protect, and restore, and discussion took place. In the committee, Cultural and Outdoor Resources Committee, during the session, it was on the agenda two more times, and we had extensive discussion of the words and definitions, protect, restore, and enhance. There were no members of the public or interested groups that came and gave us substantial differences or particulars to discuss or suggestions to make on how to change what is in law in Chapter 172. When there was no more forthcoming, no more people that were telling us what was wrong or how the words should be changed, we did not include it on our agenda again. But no one on the committee made changes, and we, although it was asked for in writing, particulars from any interested parties for changes in the definitions, we didn't get anything in writing. So we feel that we talked it as far as we could talk it. And there was no discussion about putting the definitions in this bill because we are satisfied, it seems to me from what I heard from my committee members, that we are satisfied with the definitions of protect, restore, and enhance as they are in Chapter 172. The definitions that are in Chapter 172 are not the definitions that were in the House bill last year. Last year's conference committee worked out differences between the House and the Senate on the definitions of protect, restore, and enhance. And 10 people, 5 in the House and 5 in the Senate, signed the conference committee report last year, which accepted the definitions of protect, enhance, and restore. But I knew there was still some dissension about those definitions. And I read what I read to you on the floor of the House and said the definitions would be reviewed and discussed. And the committee that I am in charge of, the committee that I can set the agenda for, did review and discuss the definitions of protect, restore, and enhance. Three times in our committee. And so I feel that I've been true to my word. And I don't know about, I don't have control over the other committees that didn't make the review. But I am secure in my intent that I carried it out.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to address Representative Hackbar's point on the audits. State agencies are very accustomed to and familiar with the legislative auditor and the important role of oversight, independent oversight, that the legislative auditor's office plays here in St. Paul. But in this bill, there are funds going through DNR to non-governmental organizations, and one of the concerns is that these non-governmental organizations may not be as accustomed to that role of the legislative auditor. The Lasard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council has a very good process in the projects that they accept and that they consider about accomplishment plans and goals for these restorations and enhancements and protection plans that come before them. They are very careful to make sure that the project proposers know that you need to have goals and outcomes. What this language will do is make it very clear to all those, whether they're a state agency like Bowser or DNR or a non-governmental organization who accepts one of these grants for completing these projects, that there indeed will be oversight and that their goals, Representative Hackbarth, that their goals and the outcomes that they proposed in their project, they'll be held to their own standards. And I would anticipate, I'm not going to presume to tell the legislative auditor how to do their job, but I would anticipate that those goals and outcomes in those project proposals would be the standards that individual project proposers, whether they are state agencies or non-governmental organizations, would be held to benefit the taxpayers.
Anything further, Representative Hackmark?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I understand, Representative Murphy, that you discussed this, but I think some folks were under the assumption that you might be doing something to change those definitions and fix that controversy. And also, Representative Morgan, when you have language in here that says that the legislative auditor has to go out and hire scientists and other appropriate persons, that's pretty vague. And you're giving the legislative auditor that's supposed to all of a sudden know something about hiring these special people and who they are, and you don't say who they are, that's my concern. I understand that the legislative auditor looks at money and issues that we spend money on and to see if the money is being spent properly. But to look at these particular issues that the legislative auditor doesn't know anything about, quite frankly, I think it's pretty vague in this language. So I'm very, very concerned about that portion of the bill. I think Representative Murphy does a noble job in putting together her committee and her appropriations, but I think there's some areas in this bill that we have some very, very grave concern over, and I'll have to recommend that we do not vote in favor of the bill.
Representative Kahn.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and perhaps I can just historically talk about Representative Hackbarth's concerns. Because I got involved with the legislative auditor, this is probably going, I'm not sure if it's 20 years ago or 30 years ago, but the issue was something that was much more difficult than these issues, and that was the whole issue of information systems in the state, and it was there was literally nobody on staff who had any real understanding of the complicated way that you did contracts to develop information standards. And then in the process of doing this, you can go back in the Legislative Reference Library and see a series of legislative auditor reports on it. They went out and contracted with someone who would do the initial report and look back on it. At the conclusion of that, I think, which ended up very satisfactory for the state and, you know, certainly for their report, at the conclusion of that, they then decided that there was enough stuff going on with information systems in the state that they really need to have some expertise in the legislative auditor's division. And so they proceeded to, over the years, develop that to the extent that they are now the prime source for executive agencies to raid when they want someone who really understands information systems. They're critical issues for all of us, like security and so forth. So having looked at that history, I mean, I don't know if there's anyone there who specific, and point out, as has been said often, legislative auditor does not just look at money. They also look at programs, and this is specifically part of their program analysis. And I think the person that you possibly, who's most responsible for these sections, who you should talk to is Representative Beard, because we work, who's a member, I believe, of the Legislative Audit Commission, and it was his bills that we worked from when we did that. But just that I know information systems is different than natural resource systems. I think, if anything, it's a more difficult system, and looking at the competency of the legislative auditor over the years in dealing with that system, I think they have every ability to deal with this one, which at least uses words that the average fifth grader can understand.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on Representative Kahn's comment, I and Representative Hilty, Representative Szymanski, we sit on the Legislative Audit Commission, and as members may know, this is a routine part, it seems to me, of what they do. It's not just money. And I'm wondering if we might, Mr. Chair, just get Mr. Nobles, since he's sitting there, to respond to this. And in particular, Mr. Nobles, if you have the bill in front of you, I think what Representative Hackbarth was pointing to is page 36, lines 24 through 26, when it says the audit must include a critical analysis of the restoration goals and objectives, scientific evaluation of the results, and the effectiveness of the restorations in meeting applicable restoration requirements. And then I think you heard him talk about the discretion or authorization on line 27 to hire or contract with scientists or other appropriate persons. Could you just tell us whether this is outside or inside the normal scope of your office?
Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chairman and members, let me answer that question by telling you what current law says about our responsibility. This was law established in 1975, so it's been a longstanding part of our work. Minnesota statute says the legislative auditor shall conduct program evaluations to determine the degree to which activities and programs entered into and funded by the state are accomplishing their goals and objectives, including a critical analysis of goals and objectives, measuring program results and effectiveness, alternative means of achieving the same results, the efficiency and the allocations of resources. The legislative auditor shall recommend ways to improve the effectiveness of programs, reduce the cost of providing state services, and eliminate services of one agency that overlap and duplicate with services of the other. So I guess that answers your question. This has been clearly within the scope of the work of the legislative auditor for several decades now. And we do confront a lot of very complex issues. We have a fairly experienced and well-educated staff to address these issues. And when the challenges go beyond the staff that we have, we hire consultants to help us.
Representative Simon.
Just to follow up, the language here, I think, that we're talking about says the legislative auditor shall hire or contract with scientists and other appropriate persons. Do you now contract with scientists and other appropriate persons?
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Simon, we do on occasion, yes, when we have the resources and we feel the need.
Representative Hackbar.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Nobles, what does that mean, other appropriate persons?
Mr. Nobles.
Who are those other appropriate persons? Who are they going to be?
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Hackbarth, I think it would obviously depend on the issues that are involved. They could be a wide range of different scientists. I guess my only suggestion to you, this is not our language, but that you might want to change the shall to may so that you leave it at our discretion. You know, I think we will clearly recognize when we need expertise beyond the ability of the resources that we have. But when you get into some of these areas of scientific expertise, it could include a wide range of people with backgrounds and degrees in various subjects.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that we're talking about scientists. That's in one group already. Or other appropriate persons. So I'm not sure who those might be. That might be me, Mr. Chairman. Put me on that list. I want to be hired. I want to come and give you my my expertise on a particular piece of property, whether the restoration was done correctly or not. Put me on that list, because I want to be hired to do that.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'll leave this language for you all to sort out.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Taking the legislative auditor's recommendations, I'd like to propose an oral amendment then on line 36.27 to strike the word shall and replace it with the word may.
Okay, does everyone have that proposal?
Line 36.27, change across the word shall and replace it with may. Any discussion?
Representative Murphy, your reaction to that?
I would accept that.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think along that same line, and since you're on kind of an oral amendment situation, my question would be for Mr. Nobles, and that is having to do with when you issue your legislative audit report, do you include the names of those that you have used as some outside expertise from the legislative auditor? Do you include those names and their educational backgrounds or any such things or what they were used for in regards to when you issue your report?
Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chairman, members, yes, we do. As we have a transmittal letter at the beginning of all of our reports, we recognize the people who worked on the evaluation.
Mr.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yes, and do you include that then, that transmittal, is that also in the final report that is available for public review?
Mr. Yes, Mr. Chairman, members, I'm referring to the transmittal letter that is a part of the final report. So we recognize the staff who've worked on it. And obviously, information beyond the recognition of the individuals by name would certainly be a matter of public record. So anybody that would want to know and see the contract, for example, that we used to hire somebody, the process we use, which would typically be an RFP process. We would lay out the kinds of experience and the tasks to be performed, and hire people on the basis of interviews and credentials.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that addressed my question, but I think just as a point, I think when you have a situation like this, more information made readily available, included in the report of some degree is always helpful. Thank you.
Any further discussion of the Simon oral amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Any further discussion on the main bill? Seeing none, then Representative Murphy renews her motion that House File 3790 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Motion carries. And committee is adjourned.